The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so I want to talk a bit more now about this living of an awakened life, this dharma life that we're cultivating moment to moment, as noted in our meditation. And I want to start with what Diana was talking about in her offering earlier, which is that when we relax and let go deeply, then it can become in us, that sense can become a reference point or a memory, almost a felt memory of something that we know is possible. I love that she said, we know it's possible. And then even if, you know, life flows on in some other way, something in our heart knows from our insights that certain things are possible, certain understandings or views. And this allows us to kind of have a reference point, or if we could say a juxtaposition of freedom and cautness. And the freedom that we remember from certain experiences can contrast with however much cautness we have at a given moment. And it helps inform. It helps us know which way to go from our current level of cautness to some level of freedom. So whatever our deepest experience is, no matter what it is, can become a reference point for us. And so it's important, therefore, to honor your deepest experience in some way, not grasp onto it as something that we attach to and try to repeat or things like that. I know that tendency can be there, but there can also be a sense like, oh, it's all just impermanent. I shouldn't, just move on. And instead, I want to encourage you to really be aware of the things that you know that are deep and profound for you, that you're sure about, at least for now, and use those as reference points. So also, Diana noted that when we have an insight, it can shift our view, and people even commented on that also. And that's a good way to see it. And the view, if you recall, is the first step of the Eightfold Path. So when we have a shift in view, we sort of, in a sense, start a new iteration of the path. And because of our differing way of seeing things, we may find that we have different intentions. And then that leads to different actions. And then what we do can help us develop our mind in different ways, which may then lead to another insight and a different view. So it's kind of a spiral. With any shift in view, the path begins anew, in a sense. So this is an evolutionary process. It's the evolution of right view, and it's also the evolution of the whole path going forward. I would guess that you've already undergone in your practice, however long it's been, some shifts in perspective. For example, many people, when they first come to meditation or mindfulness or whatever your door is, have the perspective or the understanding that, oh, I'm starting to see patterns in myself that I'm going to need to pay some attention to. People tend to slow down a bit or start to look inward a little bit more than they were before. They realize, oh my gosh, all of my attention was outside. Now maybe I should look a little bit inside. That is actually a shift in perspective. Even if it's as simple as realizing, oh my gosh, my mind is crazy, which is often the first insight. That's a shift in perspective if you didn't know that before. And it makes big changes in our life. And, there may even be other shifts that have more of an external effect. Like we realize we need to do something different at work than we were doing before, or work less, change our job in some way, some things that start to get more noticeable. Or some people realize that they want to go more into service. They realize they don't have that component in their life, and so they add something like that. So I'm not, I think I'm trying to point out that life on the path doesn't have to look any particular way. of course, it will be ethical, but beyond that, there can be so many different things that we feel unfolding in us as our perspective changes. And it's fine to honor those as they come up. You don't need to feel like, well, okay, now I'm going to do things this way, and then I'm going to shift to this, and then later my life's going to look like this. You don't know that yet. Just sort of do every step as it goes along, and don't worry that it looks different than your Dharma friend who's doing a different path. Jack Kornfield says in an article called Expressions of Enlightenment, "Whatever our gate to enlightenment, the first real taste, stream entry, is followed by many more tastes as we learn to stabilize, deepen, and embody this wisdom in our own unique life. Each person manifests enlightenment with his or her or their own flavors." So even if you don't think you're really manifesting like enlightenment yet, if that's kind of a big word, we are manifesting the path, and it's going to look different, different flavor. I like that for each person. So I think part of our job on the path is to discern how we're turning out, if you will, as we go along, and to be willing to go with what that actually is, as opposed to what we're hoping for or thinking it would be, or we read in a book, it should go like this. Speaking of flavors, Misha Merrill once said, "You might think that you're becoming a chocolate cake, but then you turn out to be a steak." And it's surprising, especially if you're a vegetarian, if that's what's happening. So, you know, we don't know how the path is going to turn out. It's not really like that, you know, what color is your parachute kind of exercise, which is a little bit more cognitive. And it relies a little bit on thought and analysis. And that's, I'm pointing to something different here, more of a discernment as we walk, you know, a discernment as we walk. Also, I think some of these cognitive analyses assume that there's a self who's wearing that parachute and is going to have some kind of taking charge in life. But we don't have such a plan necessarily always on the path. Sometimes it's nice to have a plan, but not always. In the Dharma life, I would say that our path is built more by our immediate actions, taking shape as we walk it. So it's an oft-used image, but, you know, we take a step forward and the ground comes up to meet us. You know, there's a way in which the path doesn't exist until we start to walk it, until we start to take a step forward. And sometimes there's some hesitation about that because we're not sure that it's really going to be there and it's really going to meet our foot if we step forward. But the flip side of it is that actually it has to. We've seen how conditions flow, and it's guaranteed that if you take the first step on the path, something has to come of it. It can't be nothing. And so feel free to step forward well and just keep paying attention, and there will be something there. There will be a path there. Just might not be what we expected. So I'm going to offer a verse now from the Samyutta Nikaya that I kind of like. It's called Passing Through Bewilderment from the Connected Discourses. "Resounding with a troop of nymphs, accompanied by a troop of goblins, this forest is called bewildering. How does one travel through it? Straight is the name of the path. Fearless is the name of the destination. The chariot, called noiseless, is fitted with Dharma wheels. Conscience is its bench, mindfulness the upholstery. The Dharma, I say, is the charioteer. Right view runs ahead. Whoever has such a vehicle, whether a woman or man, has, with this vehicle, approached Nibbana." So it's nice. It's about traveling through this bewildering forest in our Dharma chariot. But notice that it's a nice chariot image, and you don't have to remember what all the things referred to. It's not so critical. But I do want to point out that the chariot is not driven by you. The Dharma is the charioteer, according to this analogy. The Dharma is the charioteer. So I don't think this is something supernatural or anything, but it's more like it means that your orientation is different. We're orienting and being guided by the Dharma as opposed to something else, or what our society told us we should do, what our family told us we should do, what our ideological idealizations told us we should do. But instead, going moment by moment, you can't really plan a whole chariot route if you haven't driven that road before. You have to pay attention and go around the rocks and get past the mud patches and so forth. And the Dharma can be the charioteer doing that. So it might be that our life still looks kind of normal and conventional. As lay people, we still live here in the world, but our orientation can be different. It can be different on the inside. There's a tradition in the Tibetan tradition, one strand of it recognizes that people who are awakened sometimes will sing a song as their realization. There are songs of realization that are celebrated in that tradition that are called Doha. And usually they're kind of long and poetic, so I won't read a long one. But I did find one that's really short by a practitioner named Krishna. And it goes like this. My mind is topsy-turvy. That's it. And I don't think it's meant in the usual way that we might think of that phrase, like I'm gone crazy or something is wrong or bad or something. I think what he's saying, this is my interpretation, is that he's no longer going by conditional values or conventions. His mind has turned over to a whole different way of seeing things. And so compared to other people, maybe his mind looks topsy-turvy, but this is an awakening song. So he's saying, wow, this is fantastic. My mind was not quite right before. A little bit more conventionally, we're always more boring in the Theravadan tradition. There was a Thai teacher who called the state that we get into on retreat, where we're kind of in samadhi and seeing things through Dharma eyes. She called that normal and said that our regular life was mostly insane. So sort of the inverse of yogi mind, where we think we've gone a little nuts on retreat. She said, no, that's normal, actually. So just to be a little bit concrete about this different way of seeing things, we don't have to live like we're on retreat all the time. But suppose, in our daily life, as part of our life, suppose that we're a social activist or in some way working for the good of people. That's one thing that we find is important. You can find plenty of conventional support for doing that activity out of anger, out of fear, out of wanting, all kinds of typical emotions that are reactive, essentially. You would have no trouble finding support for that if you want to do that kind of work in that way. And if you're not succeeding at what you're doing, then it's okay that you can feel deflated and angry, or you can be pumped up to really try harder next time. We got to struggle harder next time. All of that would be fine conventionally, but it's also a lot of suffering. It's a lot of suffering, and that's why a lot of such people burn out. And also, they're aware that they're suffering for doing that. So sometimes they learn the Dharma and they think, well, I'm going to have to give all that up and be peaceful and calm and let people walk over me and let injustices in society just go on because we're all supposed to be nice people. But actually, an awakened person could also do social action, but they would not do it out of anger or fear or wanting. From a Buddhist perspective, they would do it in line with the Dharma. The Dharma would be the charioteer. So the mind would be connected with not causing suffering and also not suffering itself in doing that process. So you can engage in this kind of work out of compassion, out of care, out of love, perhaps flavored by wisdom, such that you don't exert so much effort that you get too tired. And also, or stressed for that matter. And also, if for some reason the action doesn't succeed, which there's no guarantee it will, then the mind would say, well, now would be a good time for equanimity. That would be another way to bring in wisdom. And then it would assess what to do next. So it's the same on the outside, but very different on the inside. And you see this difference in you know, in people acting out in the world, people who are acting out of wisdom and compassion, and those who are acting out of anger and fear and other such things. So this leads us toward a happiness that is not as tied to worldly conditions, not as tied to how things are in the world, but is more coming from inside of us. And so awakened people, therefore, are free to be happy much of the time, which is very nice. So we might not be completely free, but at least we can understand that the Dharma life is moving us in the direction of being happy outside of the conditions of life. Remembering from the quote that I read, which was, by the way, from Stephen Batchelor, that was the quote in the meditation, says that the path is found amidst the most mundane of circumstances as well as the most sublime. So when the Dharma is in charge, not us, then we can be surprised about how the path unfolds. It's found everywhere. And it becomes really kind of a joy to roll along in our chariot, which luckily we don't have to pilot. The Dharma can do that for us. So it's this moment. It comes down to this moment unfolding in your unique life, getting from this moment to the next moment. And your unique life has all the perfect conditions for awakening. This is again from Jack Kornfield. So is enlightenment a myth? No, it is not far away. It is freedom here and now to be tasted whenever you open to it. And in the words of the Buddha, if it were not possible to free the heart from entanglement, I would not teach you to do so. But just because it is possible to free the heart, there arise the teachings of the Dharma of liberation, offered open-handedly for the welfare of all beings. Aim for nothing less. So what's that going to look like for you? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kim. That got me thinking about, I think I'm going to be a chocolate cake, but maybe I'm going to be a steak. I don't know why, that just tickles me. I love it. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so now we'd like to have an opportunity for you all to speak amongst yourselves. Here we go again with one of these, another breakout group. I see David, you're like leading forward. So this one will be a little bit different than what we've done before in the sense that there'll just be two of you, except there'll be one group that has three. We're not an even number here. And the question is, what is a surprising new trait that has arisen as a consequence of your practice? So maybe you've discovered something new about yourself, or maybe there's just been the freedom for something that was in you to blossom, or maybe it's some activity or some way of thinking or noticing or engaging with the world. Or so there's so many different things that we can do here. So we're not going to spend that much time in the small groups. We're just going to have 8 minutes, but there's only two of you. And you can, I'm trying to think, I don't know which would be exactly the best way. Is this like 2 4-minute monologues, or is it you just say a little bit and then you go back and forth? So why don't between the two of you kind of figure it out and take care of each other, making sure that one person doesn't speak the whole time, but do maybe a little bit more relaxed, natural, less contrived way, and taking care of each other at the same time. So, I see somebody just left. So now I think everybody is going to be in just a group of two. Okay.
Sheila has her hand raised.
Oh, yep, Sheila. I was close. I almost clicked the button. Yes, what would you like to say? Can you unmute, please, Sheila?
What is a surprising
new characteristic, new trait, new activity, new thought process?
Okay.
That was a good question. Yep. Okay. Here we go. So welcome back. Welcome back. And would you be surprised if we said, now we'd like to hear from you guys. How was that? How was the small group? Were there any aha moments, or maybe you hadn't really thought about that new characteristics, traits, actions, or so whatever you'd like to share.
Wow. You're totally the same person that you were when you started meditation practice. Nothing has changed at all. Or you weren't surprised by the changes. Oh, Bess, okay.
So one thing I forgot to say in group, which is huge, is self-compassion. Before I started studying the Dharma, I had no clue that even existed, you know? So that has really been a life changer that I totally credit, you know, studying the Dharma with. I never would have figured that out without this.
Yeah, thank you, Bess, for pointing out, right, some of the things that are in the Dharma are just not in our society or in our culture, and we need something like the Dharma to point them out. Yeah. Thank you. And self-compassion is a beautiful one. Thank you, Bess. Yes, Catherine.
I really appreciate the question, because I found myself talking about stability in my relationship that I've had for 4 years, and so wow, thanks a lot, meditation. Because I can sit and because I can stay with the difficulty of to another person. I'm feeling much more stable, very surprisingly more stable.
Nice. Yeah. And it's what an impact that can have on our lives too, if we feel more stable. Yeah. Thank you, Catherine. Anybody else have a comment? Or? And we're also, maybe I'll just open it up to anything you'd like to ask, right? We're getting near the end of the day of the last class. So any question you have. Chris, did you have your hand up? And then.
Yeah, I'll just offer up. I think since the beginning of COVID, this past 10 months, it's been really clarifying my intention. What my intention is, and I don't know what it is yet, but I know it's to decrease my suffering. And the suffering I cause others. And this group has just been wonderful. We've covered quite a lot of stuff after reviewing this, how much, and there's so much food for thought here. Each topic could be a whole year's practice. So I want to thank that. And I want to really thank everyone in the group, how you've kind of really put yourselves and offered out so much. I've learned so much from everyone else in the group. And thank you very much, teachers. It's been just really great.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chris. Little crash course in the Dharma. Then Yankwe gives us a thumbs up. Thank you. But I don't, Yankwe, you're doing that as a thumbs up, not as a raising your hand, right? Yeah. Okay. David.
I'd also like to thank the Sangha and Kim and Dan and both of these. It's been a really helpful workshop to be part of. I appreciate everyone's feedback. And the break room was being so authentic and so warm and so human. So thank you everyone for that and how it was led as well. So in terms of how my practice has changed my traits, I think that in retrospect, I feel like I have more stability now. But it's interesting because when I started practicing the Dharma, I didn't really know why I was doing it. I just sort of, it seemed to connect and be authentic, but I've gone through a lot of changes in the past few years and I'm grateful for having had the practice to work with how to work with challenges and difficulties when they have arisen. So, but I didn't really know why I was doing it, but now it's like, oh, this is why I was doing it. So that's been helpful. But it's a process as always. But yeah, gratefulness to all of the group. And oh, quick question. When I look up in the Zoom and it says it's recording, but I don't know where the recording is going. Where are these recordings being kept?
They're on audiodharma.org. And there's a series that's, I think it's Dharma Life. And I think Kim Allen is the, if you look under Kim Allen, you'll find it there. So you can either look on the first date of our class, which was January 7, 8, 9, something like this, and you'll see it. And each class has three parts. So there's like class one, part one, class one, part two, class one, part three. So everything's there.
I've been including the link in those emails I've been sending out. And because you've asked, I think I'll just send one more short one later that has that link in it. So you have it for sure.
Okay, thank you so much. Oh, one last quick message. Chris, please check your chat box.
Secret messaging going by.
Passing notes in class.
Yeah, there you go, passing notes.
Okay, well, Stephen.
Just a quick question. Rob's work is what Rob has contributed, is it particularly relevant to certain aspects?
I didn't hear the last thing. Okay,
you cut out for a moment there, Stephen. Particularly relevant to...
Yeah, I was just curious to ask whether Rob's contributions to the Dhamma are particularly relevant to certain aspects of practice or of developing practice.
Well, the topics that he covers in the book that we referred to, the subtitle of it is Meditations on Emptiness and Dependent Arising. So that tells you the main territory that he's operating in. Maybe Diana has more.
One thing I'll say is that what Kim and I were drawing from is from Robert Bay's book, which is from his work, maybe from 2010 before. And then after that, he took emptiness and went a different direction. He went into soul-making Dharma, which eventually started being called that, which is something really different. And so if you go to listen to his talks, you'll get something really different than what's in his books, unless you listen to his talks before 2010. So when you say Rob's contribution, I'm assuming you mean to his earlier stuff that's in the books.
Yeah, thank you. Because I have noticed that. I'm not familiar with his work in detail, but I have looked at it in recent months a little bit. And so you've actually answered my question.
Thank you. Yeah, he's been through several phases. And for those who don't know, he's no longer alive. He died last year. Yeah. Okay, well, Diana and I also want to thank you and for your participation. And I also just want to give a little overview to kind of, because we have covered a lot, as Chris pointed out, and Diana said it's like a tour of the Dharma. So just to kind of bring us together over in these last moments is we started with a couple of sessions about methods, essentially. And we talked about inquiry and asking questions and having a kind of a investigative way of approaching life. And then we also looked at suttas as a big support for making sure that our practice is in line with the Dharma and having a relationship with these ancient wisdom teachings that are so foundational to the path. And then we do three sessions that cover essentially the three main trainings that are offered in Buddhism, of ethics, and we call it ethics in relationship, and then samadhi in heart, and then wisdom and insight as the kind of sila, samadhi, panya, but in a way that was maybe slightly non-traditional, not in its, let's say, not in the way it connected to the suttas. It was all still there, but just the language we used for modern lay people in the West. And then we had our last session today on awakening and on building all of this into your unique Dharma life. And so the hope is that you somehow feel empowered through all of this to take that next step, whatever it is for you, and start to use the Dharma as a reference point, as a foundation, as an inner support, and in doing so to become in some way, and not really, you know, kind of blatantly, but an explicit, sort of an implicit way, become a model in the world of living well, living ethically, living kindly, living with some clarity and calm and intentionality about what you do in the world. People notice that, and it matters. It starts spreading outward in all kinds of ways, even if you don't go and do some major change or become a leader in some way. Just living this way adds a lot of good to the world. And I also want to just offer a bow to my co-teacher, Diana, and it's been a real pleasure. And thank you. Thanks to everyone.
Oh, I would just bow to my co-teacher too. Thank you, Kim. Let's do another class.
Keep your eyes out.
So maybe I'll just mention, for those of you who want to do a little bit of the study and practice, Kim and I are teaching with two of our other friends, David Laurie and Ying Chen. And we'll be teaching a course in April where we're taking one particular sutta and we're just going to spend some time with it, unpacking it. And you'll find that on the IMC website. I can't remember, the first date is April
17th.
17th.
It's a Saturday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday class.
So four classes in 1 week. And we'll have more details and a description and all that kind of stuff will be on the IMC calendar, I don't know, in a few days, in a week or something like that, and a link to register, all that kind of stuff, just like how it was for this class. Yeah, so deep bows, very deep bows of appreciation. I just love, you know, sharing the Dharma in this way and kind of rolling up our sleeves together and exploring and investigating. So maybe we can unmute ourselves and say goodbye and wishing everybody well. So thank you and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thanks everybody.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Kim, wherever you are. Be well.
Bye-bye.
I'm always last to go. Well, almost there. Okay.
Almost there.